It's been a little more than a week since a group of armed men walked into a concert hall just outside of Moscow and gunned down dozens of defenseless people. As I record these words, the death toll stands at 144, rising yet again just a few hours ago after another hospitalized victim succumbed to their injuries. A branch of the Islamic State active in South Central Asia, known as Islamic State Khorasan, or ISK, claimed responsibility for the Moscow attack in a statement through an affiliated media channel. That same channel later published body cam footage recorded by the terrorists in the concert hall during the attack. Western intelligence officials say they have corroborated ISK's responsibility claim. Though ISK says the concert hall killings are its work, Russian national security officials, including President Putin in several public statements, have argued that Moscow's enemies in Kiev, Washington, and London are the attack's true masterminds. Russian authorities have arrested four Tajikistani nationals they say acted as the gunmen, and several more people are now in custody on suspicion of aiding and abetting the killings. Before the four main suspects were arraigned in court, videos circulated online showing Russian security forces torturing them after their capture. Despite this treatment then and presumably in the days since, so far only two of the four defendants have pleaded guilty to all charges. So let's talk about the perpetrators of this heinous act, the fluid geopolitics that drive such terrorism, and the road ahead for Russia as the Kremlin tries to utilize this tragedy for its own aims. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Howdy folks, welcome back to the Naked Pravda. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, and this week's show is devoted to last week's horrific terrorist attack outside Moscow. As I indicated in my introduction, Moscow and the West have expressed very different interpretations of who is to blame for organizing and orchestrating the concert hall attack. To get a sense of what is most likely and feasible in identifying the attack's masterminds, I spoke to Dr. Jean-Francois Ratel, an adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa, where he researches violent militarism in Eurasia and political ethnography in conflict studies. How plausible is it, in your view, based on obviously the limited information that is available, how plausible is it that this terrorist attack was committed by ISK?
I think there's no doubt at all that the Islamic State itself has a link and a level of organizational role in the attack, meaning that the pictures the photos they have put online, the videos they obtain that they also publish online are their main agency, underline that without a doubt the Islamic State, at least in Syria and Iraq, has a major role into the operation. Now, with regard to the Islamic State Khorasan, it seems that it's plausible that they, being the leading force, particularly with regard to their claims against Russia, about striking Russia in Russia and in Afghanistan, based also with regard to the use of Tajik individuals and the network in Istanbul and in Turkey, points toward the Islamic State Khorasan. So overall, I think it's fairly plausible that we're facing with an expansion of the activities of the Islamic State Khorasan.
Is this attack on the concert hall, does it resemble previous attacks that ISK has carried out? Does it follow a pattern?
We don't have enough attack outside of Afghanistan to really establish a pattern, but looking how structured the attack in Iran was at the beginning of the year, it's plausible that this type of attack could have been organized by the Islamic State Khorasan, but we would not have enough comparative material to go and say this is how they usually tactically and operationally lead operation, especially on Russian territory.
Dr. Ratel is referring here to an ISK attack in January this year in Iran, where suicide bombers in the southeastern town of Kerman targeted a crowd that was commemorating the anniversary of the death of the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, whom then-President Donald Trump had assassinated in a drone strike outside Baghdad in 2020. The ISK attack killed more than 84 people and wounded more than 200 more. ISK is a hardline Sunni group and considers Shiite Muslims, who comprise the majority of Iran's population, to be heretics.
It is surprising to see their access to weapons, explosives, and resources around Moscow for a group that have about no network in Russia per se. So that's the surprising aspect. We would not be surprised if Chechen or North Caucasian groups would have organized that. It's something that's similar than to attacks that we've seen around Russia. But the fact that a foreign organization without clear established network can do that in our current context in Russia is very surprising. So I would not be, it would not be out of the expected possibilities that they were supported by existing jihadist group in Russia. But for now, we don't have any clear proof that the Islamic State Caucasus province or Chechen groups or Dagestani groups have any link to that.
For another perspective on the plausibility of explanations for the Moscow Concert Hall attack and the wider operations of ISK, I spoke to Dr. Domitila Sagramoso, a senior lecturer in conflict and security in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, where she researches violence in Russia and Eurasia.
I think that the most convincing version of events is probably related to ISIS-K or ISIS Khorasan, sometimes also called ISKP. I think that there is quite a bit of evidence pointing in that direction. First of all, we can start by the attack itself. I think that these kind of attacks have been carried out by ISIS and ISIS affiliates several times in the past. The one that immediately comes to mind is the attack in 2015 in France in the Bataclan, where also a group of fighters just randomly shot at civilians in a concert hall. So here we have a similar episode. It is also interesting, as we know, the fact that the information has been transmitted through official ISIS channels. So not only the revendication, the claim of the attack, but also the video. So that means that the video that was filmed by the perpetrators of the attack must have reached somehow ISIS operatives, who were then able to download it and present it through their channels. And so those who are following ISIS very closely have been able to verify that these were sort of official ISIS channels. And so I personally tend to believe that the most convincing argument or the most convincing line of argument behind the perpetrators of this attack is probably ISIS. ISIS Khorasan in particular was my suspicion, because we know now that there's a strong or powerful contingent of Tajik fighters within this group. And Central Asians have also been active in jihadist activities beyond the borders of the areas where they live. And they've been active in Europe. They've been active in Iran. There was also the case of a plot that was uncovered by the German security forces in Cologne. And these were also a group of Tajiks who wanted to put a bomb or an explosive in a church in Cologne. So also that's quite interesting. Another interesting element is the question of the narrative, which was brought forward by ISIS in the first declaration, fighting against sort of the infidels, against the crusaders, very much fits within the ISIS narrative. And I think one element which is often left a bit aside or not considered enough is the power of ideology, which I have studied very much in the context of the North Caucasus. And it's really important to consider that the ideological dimension or the perception that these individuals are fighting a sort of a real religious Islamist jihad is very powerful. And many of those who fight in these groups, they become highly convinced. Now, these group of four perpetrators might look a bit different. We've seen some of the interrogations where one of them claims that he was involved because he was given some money. That also fits the narrative or the characteristics or features that we have seen of Islamist groups in Central Asia. Many of those, for example, joined what was at the time called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which was then taken over by ISIS, joined at the time because they were given sort of monetary compensation. And so we should also not forget that for some, the receiving monetary support might also be a reason why they join these groups. They might find themselves on the sidelines, on the margins of society, without any jobs, feeling alienated. And that can especially be the case of Tajiks who are working as migrants in Russia, for example. They feel alienated from their society surrounding them. They cannot find proper jobs. The jobs they may be carrying out might be quite demeaning for them. So there might also be a psychological element that joining these groups might give them meaning, might give them a lifeline in terms of financial support. So I think there are a variety of reasons why individuals might join these groups. In the case of Central Asia, it's also interesting because the Central Asians have been involved, especially Tajiks, have been involved to a certain extent in the war in Afghanistan, on the side of the Taliban, apparently, quite recently, when the Taliban took over most of Afghanistan. There's apparently a group of Tajiks that were supporting the Taliban on the borders with Tajikistan. So there is a history of militancy of Tajiks in Central Asia. As we know, many also traveled to Syria and to Iraq during the height of the Syrian civil war and during the existence of the Islamic State. So there's also a contingent of what we call sort of foreign fighters who went to Syria and Iraq, and it's not clear what happened to them afterwards. So there is also a dimension there which is important to consider.
Is it surprising to you that men from Tajikistan would be the perpetrators in this? Does that make sense to you, given what is known about ISK?
From ISK, we would expect them to use Tajik or Uzbek in Russia if they would want to curry attack. I'm not surprised that any organization are more successful at recruiting Tajiks and Uzbek in Moscow. It's something that was expected since 2016. It's become much more difficult for Russians, Russian citizens in general, but people from the Caucasus and the Volga to organize a terrorist group. So I think many experts were expecting a higher mobilization among migrant workers and recruitment. First, because Russia did not have extensive intelligence networks in the communities. Also, second, because we see usually a rise of lone actors recruitment in those migrant communities since 2016. So overall, if you look at it, if it's the Islamic State Khorasan, it would make sense to focus on Tajik and Uzbek. If in the current context of jihadist group in Russia, there was more possibilities to see Central Asians rather than North Caucasian being involved in such network.
Is there something special that makes Tajikistan particularly fertile recruiting grounds for groups like ISK? Or is it just the fact that there's a lot of poverty? I mean, it seems that there's a lot of poverty, a lot of places. Why Tajikistan of all places? Why even Tajikistan of all places in Central Asia?
Thank you very much for your question, Kevin, because I'm trying to figure that out myself as well, you know, and I don't really have a straight answer. I can just give you a bit of suppositions. You know, traditionally, the Uzbeks were sort of the ones that were fighting much more in this very radical fundamentalist groups. As I mentioned, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. Previously, many of these members were part of a group called Adolat. They were very strong in the Fergana Valley in Namangan, to the point that one of the leaders was called Namangani. They then joined fighters in the civil war of Tajikistan. As we know, there was this very brutal and severe civil war in Tajikistan from 1992 until 1997, where many Uzbeks participated. What was interesting at the time was that in this civil war, there was an Islamic party, the Islamic Renaissance Party, fighting against what then became sort of the official government structures, the Rahmon regime. But this Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan was not so ideologically radicalized. It wasn't so fundamentalist, to the point that then they reached an agreement with the government and they agreed to share positions in government. And by sharing positions in government, they became less radicalized. But it seems that there has been elements within the Tajik sort of Islamic sphere that have decided to become more radicalized. And what is interesting is that they are related to those warlords who have not agreed to become part of this peace agreement in 1997. So there were sort of splinter groups or spoiler groups within the opposition that were not ready to accept the conditions of the peace agreement of 1997. So one of the groups that emerged in the mid-2000s was related to warlords in the Tajik civil war who had decided not to agree by the terms of this peace agreement. And so they sometimes resorted to violence. There was also an Uzbek warlord as part of this sort of splinter groups. But there seems to have been this group, and they have been sometimes active, and sort of carrying out violence at regional level. It was never large scale, but in sort of central Tajikistan and sometimes also in the north in Khuzand. So I think that there is a history. I mean, if I would have to highlight the elements that are there, you know, the history of the civil war usually results in sort of groups that, you know, do not demobilize, do not join the official military structures, do not join the civilian institutions, or they do not reintegrate into civilian life. And so they might have, you know, their own grudges. They might have their own reasons why they want to continue fighting. It might be also much more related to what we call the political economies of war, the spoils of war. They might be fighting not for an ideology, but also for control over particular illegal activities. So that is very typical. After civil wars, we often see high levels of criminality in some countries. So Tajikistan, in that respect, you know, fits the pattern of a post-war country with a very brutal civil war where elements have decided not to abide by the agreement. So they turn to violence and they might embrace Islam because this is a powerful ideology which might help them to recruit fighters and to carry their war more effectively. There's also a question that we might be thinking is why do they operate outside the region? The other point, of course, is Tajikistan is a very poor country. It is neighboring Afghanistan. So the spillover from the Afghan civil war and the Taliban and the very strong presence also of these ISIS groups now in that area, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, these groups are trying to recruit among Central Asians. The Tajiks are an obvious constituency. They are next door. There is a sort of a Tajik minority also in Afghanistan.
And is it common for members of this group, when carrying out attacks, to attack and then try to flee and escape? Because I know that one of the reactions among a lot of people was, hey, I thought jihadists always die in these actions, whether by suicide bombing or by sticking around till the last bullet or something like this.
It's not common, but it is not something that is not happening. If you think about Boston, if you think about Paris, if you think about Brussels, and even attacks in Russia, there is individuals that will try to escape and to continue the network or simply because they don't want to die. I think the surprise was that after such an extensive attack that they were able to get out of the concert hall and city hall over there without encountering resistance. I think they would have died there if security services in Russia would have been more efficient. So I think we would not have that question if the FSB and the National Guard would have done their job properly. We would be closer to what we have seen in Dubrovka, for example.
Do you get the sense that, I mean, this is a criticism that I've seen made in the last week, and it has obvious sort of, it has political bite to it, but I wonder if maybe it also is just a good analytical point, and that is that the Russian police state, which has expanded enormously in the last several years, it's focused so much on political crimes and political threats to the regime that it has perhaps ignored the threat of terrorism. But at the same time, I'm aware that terrorism can happen in any country. Do you view Russia as having become more vulnerable or less vulnerable to terrorism as a result of militarization over the last couple of years, or are these separate issues?
I think certainly there's not unlimited resources. So at some point when you choose to infiltrate groups, jihadist group, let's say in Turkey, or people connecting with Ukraine, you don't spend as much time internally. I think there is certainly an intelligence failure that can be about priorities. But I would not discount the fact that the Islamic State Khorasan in that case might have also been more creative on how they approach operation. You know, it was not an extensive network, profoundly anchored in Russia. It seems that a lot of it was controlled from outside of the country, that they banked on the flow of people between Turkey and Russia. So I think certainly it's not like we are in 1999 and 2000 where all the resources were focused on Chechen groups and the most active terrorist group targeting Russia. But I think it's also that Russia has struggled for the last 10 years and more to address radicalization within the Central Asian communities. The lack of ability to infiltrate, collect intelligence in those communities is underlined by the most recent attack.
And is that failure due to some flaw in the Putin regime, or is it nature of Russia's geopolitical position in the region, or is it something totally different? Like, why are they failing so badly to infiltrate these groups, as you put it?
I think it because it was a new threat. Central Asians were never the main issue in terrorism in Russia. So most networks were established on Chechens, Dagestanis, infiltrating Chechens abroad, even using the Kadyrov regime, infiltrating groups in Syria and Iraq, for example. But Central Asian came on the map as a threat much later, where Ukraine was becoming a bigger problem. So I think at that point, Russia never were able to fully develop extensive intelligence network in the Central Asian community and got sidetracked by more present issues, more urgent issues in Ukraine and abroad. So I think it's contextual, it is organizational, and I think in a way it's also underlining the migrant communities. People are moving, people are not established, you don't have a very, you know, the Propiska system and all that is not as established for migrant workers. The turnover of individual is much harder to control than you have with Russian citizens that require to have relationship with the state. So as a nice quote for, it's probably a failure connected to the context of the threat, the type of radicalization we have with the migrant communities. Obviously, the extensive resources spent on Ukraine and also the inability of the Federal Security Service and other intelligence organizations to adapt to a change in landscape of extremism.
And what about the reasons for targeting Russia of all places? Is there what does ISK, what's their beef with Russia? And what might they hope to gain by carrying out an attack in Russia? Was it just vulnerable and they went for it, or is there like an end game or a goal here?
I think if vulnerability was the first option, targeting soft target, for example, in Turkey on even in the Middle East would have been much easier for them. I think ISK is pushing the narrative that Russia has supported the Taliban, has played an extensive role of repression of the Islamic State and Muslims in Syria.
A bit of background information here. ISK is a regional branch of the jihadist group Islamic State and is active in South Central Asia, primarily in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The group seeks to destabilize and replace current governments in the region with the goal of establishing a caliphate across South and Central Asia governed under a strict interpretation of Islamic Sharia law, which they plan to expand beyond the region as well. So be on the lookout for that. The group's traditional base of power began and remains in eastern Afghanistan along the border with Pakistan, and ISK often recruits from former dissatisfied fighters and dissenters of the Taliban, with whom ISK has been locked in a violent counterinsurgency struggle. Though the Taliban and ISK actively fought against the United States, ISK has maintained a greater operational focus on attacking Taliban targets. And though these groups are usually enemies, the allegiance of their forces is sometimes fluid, with fighters from both groups sometimes changing sides or cooperating with militants from the other groups.
And add to that the traditional narrative about the wars and the two Chechen wars, and you have a picture of Russia being one of the main enemy of the Islamic State, but also operationally, they are so connected to the Taliban that it makes sense that targeting them would be on the very high on the list of ISK, high as Iran, as I, Russia, would say would be the top two targets of foreign actors. That obviously the last point of it is feasibility of opportunities. Tajiks and Uzbek have extensive reach in Russia, which they would not have in the EU or in the US. So obviously it is because Russia is one of the main enemies and because it was easier to target Moscow, for example, because of the migrants' communities and the easy connection between Turkey and Russia.
Apart from being an organization that's based elsewhere and has this distinct history, does ISIS-K, do their operations differ very much from the more familiar Islamic jihadis from the Russian North Caucasus?
Yes and no. I think that we already had ISIS operating in Russia before. There were, attacks in the St. Petersburg metro a few years ago. There were many plots that were uncovered. So it seems that the Russian authorities are aware of these groups. I think on the 7th of March, they were able to uncover a plot in a synagogue, I think in Moscow. So certainly the Russian security structures have been aware of these groups and they've tried to fight against them or to uncover them. It's not always easy to uncover every single plot. But of course, I think this level of brutality and the scope and the sort of the reach of this attack, of course, came as a surprise to Russia. You know, I think that the Chechens and the North Caucasus jihadists had carried out terrorist attacks, but they generally would be trying to seize hostages to engage in negotiations. This was the case in Beslan, and this was the case also in the Nordos theater in Moscow in 2002. Of course, in the North Caucasus, there were, you know, suicide bombings, the famous Black Widows. So this was happening. But most of these suicide bombings occurred, for example, against buildings of the local administration. I don't recall them hitting randomly at civilians. So the North Caucasian jihadists operated much more as an insurgency, and their tactics, when they became similar to terrorist attacks, often had a connotation of trying to engage into negotiations or making sure that Russia would withdraw from the North Caucasus. So the political dimension of the terrorist act was extremely relevant and clear to everyone.
During a teleconference with senior state officials coordinating the response to the concert hall terrorist attack outside Moscow, Vladimir Putin said investigators' biggest job was to determine who orchestrated the actions of the supposed radical Islamists now in custody. The president suggested that Washington's recognition of ISK's responsibility for the attack could be a deception and reasoned that the U.S. has been fighting Russia through the Kiev regime since 2014 and might puppet other forces against Moscow. Ukraine's counterattacks against Russia logically lend themselves to terrorism, Putin said, before launching into another exegesis on the supposed Nazi roots of Ukrainian nationhood and why Kiev is doomed in its war with Moscow. On Tuesday, Russian Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev told a reporter that Ukraine, not the Islamic State, is to blame for the attack. That same day, in rare remarks to the media, longtime Federal Security Service Director Alexander Bortnikov accused the Ukrainian government of training radical Islamists and then turning them loose on Russia. Bortnikov stressed that his agency's information was still preliminary, but he said he believes that the United States, Great Britain, and Ukraine are behind the deadly concert hall terrorist attack. The FSB chief also advocated designating Ukraine's security service as a terrorist organization, claiming that the four suspects were expected in Ukraine, where they would supposedly have been greeted as heroes. Medusa has learned that the Kremlin instructed state-funded and pro-government media outlets almost immediately after the attack to emphasize the possible traces of Ukrainian involvement. I asked my guest this week if what we're hearing from Moscow makes any sense to them.
I think Moscow will underline that there was a member of the Islamic State hiding in Ukraine for a couple of years. But that's where that story will end in a way, because those individuals are connected to a very different network. Those individuals don't appear to have any contacts or any networks with established Islamic State networks that we know of in Ukraine or in Turkey.
Dr. Vertel is referring here to reports about a former Islamic State fighter from Tajikistan who supposedly tried to join the Ukrainian army to fight in the Donbas. Meduza's daily Russian language podcast, Что случилось, recently spoke to journalist and Central Asia expert Галия Ибрагимова, who said some of her sources in Tajikistan have repeated stories about former IS fighters finding a place in the Ukrainian armed forces. But she stressed that she's found nothing so far in Ukraine to confirm these claims.
Regarding a direct trail back to Ukraine, let's be sure to put this phrase in quotes. Looking at recent news reports, you see mentions of someone named Abdullah, and suspects in custody seem to say in some videos that there was someone named Abdullah, and they dealt with him somehow. And Russian state propaganda is trying to present all this as if Abdullah is in Ukraine and that he was behind these terrorist attacks. I asked several of my contacts about this, and here's what I was told. Yes, there really is somebody who goes by Abdullah who'd been fighting since 2011 in the ranks of the Islamic State, the one that American forces smashed. He's originally from Tajikistan and goes by Abdullah al-Tajiki. He has another name and surname, but he uses the pseudonym Abdullah al-Tajiki. And after ISIS was crushed in the Middle East, various field commanders tried to join other radical groups. Something I heard from my contacts, which I also read about in several publications, like The Times, is that some of these ISIS fighters went to Ukraine, where at that time, there was the war in the Donbas, and allegedly the Ukrainian authorities did, in fact, allow them to fight in the ranks of the Ukrainian army. As far as this information corresponds to reality, I do not know. I tried to find sources on the Ukrainian side, tried talking to my Ukrainian colleagues who followed this issue, and this was the first they'd ever heard about it.
Meanwhile, investigative journalists at RFARL have concluded that the Abdullah mentioned in interrogation footage is probably just another alias of Shamisid Feriduni, one of the detained suspects. At least, that was his name on Odnoklassniki and Vkontakte.
So it is a fresh network from the Islamic State Khorasan that appears to have played the bigger role. And when I hear the idea that the U.S. or Britain would have a role to play, well, the Islamic State Khorasan have been targeting nonstop the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, even during the withdrawal in Afghanistan. So on many aspects, what we have so far as information paint a completely different picture. There's no Central Asian networks really involved in the war in Ukraine. Most of the foreign fighter groups are Russian citizens, from Siberia, neo-Nazis, they're Chechens, they're Dagestanis, they're Georgian. What there's no network is Central Asians linked to the Islamic State or other.
On either side, you mean? There's not a large number of Central Asians fighting on either side?
No. Yeah. No. It's they didn't have the reach to go there. They were never established there. The members of the Islamic State that were in Ukraine after 2016 are mostly Chechen and Georgians. And there's no operational link that we know except very brief connection between Central Asians and North Caucasian in Syria that would have nothing to do with this. So that narrative that Moscow is putting forward, I have very strong doubts that we will see any concrete evidence about it. I think that will be repeated as a narrative. It will be presented in a context of crisis in Russia. Some groups will choose to bandwagon on it because of the level of racism against Central Asian in certain circles in Russia. But at the end of the day, I would be extremely surprised that even in a couple of months, we find any substantial material about that. Even with what was released by Turkish intelligence and government underlines that those individuals are not connected to no network that are very known in the jihadist expert circles or what we have seen in the war in Syria and Iraq. So it appears to be something that is completely different, which once again would push toward the Islamic Khorasan more than any aspect of Ukraine or military intelligence in Ukraine.
Is this a theory that Russia's essentially pioneering, or is this said by other groups that, oh, the U.S. or Britain or whoever, they control terrorist groups, or that they kind of like push terrorist groups onto their rivals or their adversaries or something like this? Or is this sort of a distinctly Putin-esque kind of theory?
I think Iran have tried to make the similar claims about the attack in January 2024, saying that Israel organized the attack and controlling terrorist group to strike in Iran. And that narrative fell apart very quickly. I'm not aware of anywhere or anyone really believing that the U.S. or Britain really control any terrorist group. I think there's always the usual conspiracy theory that among certain extremist circle that Great Britain has been funding indirectly some Wahhabist group since the 1990s to fragment Islamic movement. But at the same time, we never really have tangible evidence underlining that. So I think in that case, Moscow will try, and certainly they will have an impact on certain nationalist group in Russia, maybe local population in certain cases. But overall, I think that's where that framing or the failure to frame the terrorists as such will end.
You know, from the Russian mindset, they are fighting a war in Ukraine. Ukraine is being supported by the West. And so the initial reaction might be the Ukrainians with whom we are fighting are in a very weak position now compared to how they were last year. So unleashing these kind of attacks comes handy to them. And, you know, the Americans are the big sponsors. That's how the Russians perceive this war. I don't agree with it entirely, but, you know, certainly the West is supporting Ukraine. So the Americans are sponsoring this war. And at the end of the day, we are in a major war with the West and with NATO. And this is not something which, from the Russian point of view, and from the Russian leadership point of view, began in 2022. It began well before. So, you know, probably someone must be behind the Americans, because this kind of attack cannot be mounted without some kind of support from the outside. You know, this idea that these groups on their own would never be able to mount such an attack. I personally do not think that that makes any sense. I think that from the Russian point of view, and from the general public, it's very easy to develop this narrative, because when you're in a situation of war of the kind Russia finds itself now, you might be tempted to think that your enemy is using any kind of instruments to hit at you. So I wouldn't discard that some of those who are producing this narrative might also believe in it, even though they have no evidence whatsoever. On the other hand, I think that probably the regime in Russia, when this attack occurred, sat down and thought, how can we manage this attack in a way that it doesn't weaken us, and in a way that we in some way can transform this big tragedy, which also shows big flaws in the security structures, to our advantage? And how can we get away or out of this hole whereby it is obvious that we were not diligent enough. There must have been a lot of negligence, a lot of casualties, a massive attack, a big fire for everyone to see, the police arriving late, not clear why, the security forces not being able to really help people inside. So there are so many deficiencies in also not just preventing the attack, but responding to it, that, you know, the regime at a certain point needs to find a way around explaining it. And it's much easier to explain that somehow a big power such as the United States is behind, rather than just a group of random jihadists who were able to go through the loops of all our security instruments in place. So to a certain extent, you know, this narrative also helps the regime to cover its back and explain why they were not able to prevent it. And at the same time, it gives ammunition to their narrative that, you know, they're fighting the West and it can galvanize a population to support their efforts in Ukraine. So it has this additional bonus of maybe mobilizing the population in the war in Ukraine and making the new wave of mobilizations, which, you know, the regime might be ready to call, easier to carry out. But that does not mean that the regime was behind this attack. I'm hearing among Western sources that, you know, there are many issues that are not clear and whether the Russian regime was behind it. I also do not stand by that line of argument. I think in every kind of attack of this sort, you can find weaknesses of the response or in the prevention element side. So I don't think that the Russian regime is behind. I think that the Russian leadership and President Putin has always been very effective at transforming, you know, moments of weakness into sort of effective responses that have benefited the regime. And I think they are really good at that.
I see regularly headlines from like the Russian state media. It's like a Wednesday or a Tuesday, and it's a little headline about how the FSB raided some supposed terrorist cell and either, you know, liquidated, or they have like some euphemism for what they do, how they kill these people, and they're gone. It's a fairly regular thing, and sometimes they specify the group that they're allegedly connected to. Sometimes they just say suspected terrorists or something like this. I'm hearing this. I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm hearing what the Russian officials are saying. And I'm wondering, are they just putting on a show? But they must see what's in front of them. And they are clearly doing at least some kind of police work that involves killing suspected terrorists. So they're not going to the White House and shooting people there if they really believe they're the ones orchestrating it. So part of me is wondering, they do real police work on this. So they must have secretly or privately a grasp of this. What's your reading here?
I think there is proper police work done against the beginning of certain networks in Russia, whether to call them Islamic State Network, or I think Russia put labels that they want on that. For a while, they were a member of the Caucasus Emirate, wherever they find them. Then it became Islamic State. Then I wouldn't be surprised if it now framed as Islamic State Khorasan. I think there is certainly groups within Russia that are organizing. We've seen attack in Ingushetia. We've seen attack in even Chechnya. There was attacks, lone actors attack in Siberia, in the Volga. So there is activities of groups across Russia. It's difficult to really assess if all the special operations are really targeting people that are actively in terrorist network or simply people that are sending money abroad or having connection with family members in Turkey. Russia has a very extensive definition of who could be targeted. Any kind of activity linked to online propaganda can also be framed as terrorism. But overall, I think what we don't see from Russia is, in all those special operations, we never see any evidence that they are connected to foreign backers or foreign networks. It seems to be based on traditional Russian-based network. It seems to be connected to non-traditional Islamic group in Russia, within Russia. So for me, what Russia has been doing in the last 4 or 5 years with regard to jihadist group point toward an internal problem, not what Russia is trying to sell, a connection between Ukraine, the West, and the Islamic State in general. Ukraine has activated all kind of other covert groups in Russia, but we don't have any evidence that they ever collaborate with any jihadists or Islamic group within Russia.
I also asked Dr. Rattel about the impact of weapons flowing back to Russia from Ukraine.
Well, I think for years, the Second Chechen War had a huge impact on having explosive and weapons around the Caucasus. So in Dagestan and Chechnya and somewhere else, I think there was weapon cache for several months and several years used by the Caucasus Emirate that came back from corruption, but also from the early years of the war. I think what we're seeing in Russia is because of people returning from the war, weapons coming back to Russia, There is a lot of weapons in the black market for different extremist groups. Yes, in that case, we've seen that those weapons might have come from Ukraine, that they were procured very easily by the leader of the group or by logistic network. But we see also all kind of murders, all kind of criminal activities connected to weapons from Ukraine. So I think the war will have a very big impact on the strength and the operational activities or capabilities of terrorist network in Russia. I think the problem of Ukraine is obviously that the FSB and other groups have less resources to address internal threat, but that is also expanding the threat at multiple levels because of this flow of weapons and the flow of individuals that went to the war and have grievances against the Russian government. So I think Russia is facing uphill battle to address extremism in the upcoming years from foreign organizations, but also from internal threat.
Are you talking about weapons that are coming from the Russian side that are being illicitly funneled back into Russia? Are you talking about Ukraine sending weapons to Russia as some kind of mission or something?
In that case, I would talk about weapons smuggled in by Russian soldiers returning home.
To make money or something like that?
Exactly. So black market to make money, sometimes just as a souvenir that they might sell later on. Corruption also. It's very difficult to keep track of the amount of weapons that are sent to the battlefield. I don't think Ukraine has really to smuggle any weapons.
Right.
If they have covert networks there, they can just buy weapons on the black market in Russia. So I think Russia is its worst enemy in that case.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.